From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, after more than 50 years of frozen diplomatic ties, the U.S. reopened its embassy in Havana, and the Cuban flag was raised over their new embassy in D.C. Secretary of State John Kerry was there.
This is the first visit to the Department of State by a Cuban foreign minister since 1958.
We are not the best of friends. Not while the trade embargo persists, not while the Guantanamo Bay prison remains open, not while Cuba jails dissidents and restricts internet access. But the Obama administration's actions on Cuba are nonetheless historic and a long time coming. In fact, Tim Padgett, America's editor at WLRN in Miami, says the path to normalization would have remained impassable were it not for a certain story that made headlines 15 years ago.
Elian was just five when a smuggler's boat headed to the United States flipped over and killed his mother. He was found clinging to an inner tube and handed over to relatives in South Florida.
More than 100 U.S. immigration agents, some with guns drawn, forcibly removed Elian from the Little Havana home of his great-uncle Lazaro Gonzalez in a lightning pre-dawn raid.
The story of the adorable Cuban boy caught in a political tug-of-war transfixed U.S. audiences for 7 months. For Tim Padgett, who covered the Elian Gonzalez saga for Time magazine, it was all-encompassing.
My son, too, was 5 or 6 years old, and I remember coming home one night a little late from covering this whole mess in Little Havana, and even as I sat down for dinner that night with my family, I was still watching out of the quarter of my eye on network news, and my son abruptly said, "Daddy, why are you spending so much time with that little boy?"
Tell me about what you were watching out of the corner of your eye. What were the dominant tropes in the coverage?
We focused too much on the micro custody battle, too much on that sensational family drama. I remember, you know, one of the few scoops I had was when I found out that one of the ways Mari Slesis, the cousin who cared for Elian the most when he was here, every day she would apparently pour him chocolate milk and remind him, "You can't get this back in Cuba." Those were the sort of things that I think we focused on when really there was a larger and more important story to be told about this dynamic between Fidel Castro and the Miami exiles. As one more moderate Cuban American here told me, Fidel and the exile leadership need this battle the way you and I need oxygen. You have to understand that by 1999, both Castro and the exiles were beginning to feel their geopolitical relevance waning. This was really sort of a last gasp on the part of both of them to try to get that relevance back.
One of the points you've made was that so much of what we're seeing today with regard to the normalization of relations between our two countries grows out of the way the national media specifically portrayed the Cuban-American community.
This was really the first time the community in Miami had ever really been scrutinized by the national media. And the national media was a little shocked, I think, to see not just the passion and the fervor in the exile community, but also a sort of intolerance for anyone who disagreed, for example, that Elian should remain here. If you disagreed with their position, you were somehow anti-Cuban American. What the national media attention and scrutiny brought out was this concern that the exile community here was behaving the way it had always criticized Fidel Castro for behaving, with this sort of authoritarian intolerance. That helped discredit this traditional old guard, hardline exile leadership and allow more moderate Cuban-American voices to come to the forefront. I really think that that's what has brought us 15 years later to where we are now in terms of this historic change in Cuba policy that we're seeing.
How exactly can you discern that change?
Well, one of the examples I point to most prominently is Carlos Saladrigas. He's a millionaire businessman here. And during the Alien Gonzalez episode, he was one of the hardline Cuban-American leaders who really believed that Alien should be allowed to stay in the United States. He was even one of the negotiators between the exile leadership and Attorney General Janet Reno. He represented the dominant voice at the time. But as the drama moved on, he began to feel the Cuban-American community was really hurting its own image with this stance it was taking. And when federal agents had to come in and swoop in, really, and take Elian away, he went on to found a very prominent group now called the Cuba Study Group, based in Washington, D.C., which has promoted engagement with Cuba. His group then, I think, encouraged other more moderate Cuban-American voices to step forward. Poll after poll began to show that Miami Cubans themselves were beginning to feel that we should engage Cuba, that we should get rid of the trade embargo, that we should get rid of the travel ban. By 2009, when Barack Obama then came into office, he felt more comfortable, I think, pursuing an engagement policy with Cuba because he felt it was more doable. One of the first foreign policy moves he made was to roll back George W. Bush's very severe restrictions on Cuban Americans being able to travel and send remittances to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out to be an extraordinarily popular measure and showed him that more was possible to do.
And what happened after Obama announced normalization?
There was supposed to be a big anti-Obama rally in Jose Marti Park in Little Havana, but only a few hundred people showed up, and much of it was, to be polite, elderly. It sort of reflected the dynamic that's going on here in the community, that the more hardline anti-engagement faction is on the wane, and a lot of that has to do with simple aging.
So give me your sense of the recent coverage of the U.S. normalizing relations with Cuba.
If I see one more picture of an American correspondent posing in front of a vintage Ford on the streets of Havana, I'm going to scream. Too often you see correspondents bring with them that attitude of, oh, I want to see the communist theme park here before it goes, you know, by the wayside. And in the early days of our coverage, we were raising people's expectations that this was going to lead to overnight democratization. Whenever you see dissidents, you know, being harassed in Cuba right now, you'll see the conservatives say, well, see, Obama's policy has done nothing. But then you've got the pro-engagement, the liberals, who keep insisting that this is going to turn Cuba into a democratic bastion and we're going to see multi-party elections, you know, tomorrow. What we have to work harder at is to sort of explain what this policy actually is. And that is simply an effort to position the United States more effectively to help influence democratic change when it does begin to bubble up in Cuba. It's not something that's going to happen while the Castro's generation of leadership in Cuba, frankly, is still there.
Elian recently told ABC News that he wants to visit the U.S. What do you make of that? And do you think any subsequent visits will be covered with the same passion?
I think it's great that he wants to come back to the United States. I just ask him, beg him, implore him, do not come to Miami. We just don't need to live through that again. I hear Seattle is beautiful this time of year.
Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tim Padgett is America's editor at WLRN in Miami. So Padgett says Cuba won't see real change until the Castro generation of leadership comes to an end. Raul Castro, Cuba's current president, says he'll step down in 2018. His older brother Fidel himself resigned from office in 2008 at the age of 81, spawning rumors that he might already be dead. But we've heard that before. He was rumored to be dead a couple of years before he assumed power. That is, until a crucial interview in the jungle. The story goes like this. It's February 1957. Ruby Phillips, longtime Cuba correspondent for the New York Times, is approached by Castro's comrades. He wants to give an interview. Phillips declines. Cuba had become her home, and she knew she'd be deported. At the very least, she'd hurt her access to the increasingly repressive government of Fulgencio Batista. But she cabled the Times and urged Herbert L. Matthews, former war reporter turned editorial writer, to do it. He'd been there before and was eager for adventure, so he went. That's essentially where New York Times reporter Anthony DePalma's story takes off, as he relates in his book called The Man Who Invented Fidel, Castro, Cuba, and Herbert L. Matthews of the New York Times. DePalma told us a few years back that Matthews was both the best and the worst person for the job. He wrote vividly, but he had a dangerous tendency to fall in love with the causes and the characters he covered.
When he was covering the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, Abyssinia then, in the early 1930s, he believed that Mussolini was doing a great thing. He later on retracted that. When he covered the Spanish Civil War, he believed that the side that he was covering, which were the loyalists, were the side of righteousness. And then in 1957, he shows up in Cuba and interviews Fidel. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. He's been up all night. He's muddy and cold. Dawn is just breaking in the Sierra. And Fidel comes through the foliage like some apparition.
What was the kind of stage management that Castro applied to the scene?
They're basically sitting on a log for 3 hours. And he lays out an image of himself as a young, democracy-loving defender of the Cuban Constitution. He says that he's got a number of men with him, armed with telescopic rifles. They've got Batista on the run. The truth is, he had 18 men at most. He had one telescopic rifle. He has his brother, Raul, send over someone and say, "Comandante, we're getting a report from the second column." Of course, with 18 men, there was no second column. But in defense of Matthews, he had checked with the U.S. Embassy in Havana. They told him hundreds of men. We had run a story citing the rebel representative in New York saying they had hundreds of men. And our resident correspondent, Ruby Phillips, who had lived in Cuba for 30 years, said, "We believe he's up there and has several hundred men behind him."
Matthews returns to New York. He writes a 3-part series. Batista was famously censoring the press. And in fact, those papers, when they arrived, literally had the stories clipped out of them.
Mm-hmm.
But an anti-Batista character was dispatched to New York to buy up the papers, clip those stories out, and send them to thousands of very important people in Cuba.
I spoke to that man, Mario Llerena is the man's name. He's now in his 90s. He was a supporter of Fidel's. He was called in by another one of the supporters and said, "We need you to go to New York." He handed him the money for the ticket and a copy of the social registry of Havana.
So they went to a great deal of trouble to get this story to the Cuban people. What was the impact?
Just last week, I spoke to someone who was there at the time. He's now an academic in New York, and he said it was electric. Here was the first real news that he was alive. It was coming from a source outside of Cuba, so it was trusted. Castro's image in Cuba at that time was a little bit of a roughneck. He had gone through a couple of other attempts at overthrowing the government that failed utterly. But here he was being presented as a leader, as a romantic figure. Remember, he was only 30 years old. He was young. He had a beard. He had these men up in the mountains.
So he was made a hero by Matthews. But wasn't Matthews made into something of a hero by Castro as well?
Absolutely. Matthews, remember, 57-year-old editorial writer at the newspaper, one day had to go through the doors of the New York Times on 43rd Street in Manhattan and pass by a demonstration supporting the articles that he wrote. Probably made it pretty embarrassing for him to deal with his colleagues.
And in fact, you write that he was already in a peculiar position of writing both for the news pages and the editorial pages. He kept saying, "Trust me, I'm a great asset to your paper." But by dint of writing his opinion in one section of the paper and what was ostensibly objective news in another part of the paper, he couldn't be trusted in either section.
It was a dangerous precedent that was never repeated. The New York Times didn't back away from it. In fact, they used his position as editorial writer and correspondent in advertisements, and they were very proud of what he did. When Castro turned and showed that his revolution was intent on becoming a communist revolution, people looked for someone to blame, and Matthews was the target, blamed by Cubans who didn't like Fidel, blamed by our United States Senate in congressional hearings, blamed by the journalistic community.
Do you think he deserved that blame?
A professor at Stanford said that blaming Matthews for Castro is like blaming the meteorologist for a storm. Even today, 50 years later, people are writing biographies of Castro and they still can't say with any real authority whether or not Castro was a communist at the time in 1957 that he did the interview. We still don't know. Did he make mistakes? Absolutely. Did he do things that the newspaper, the New York Times, should not have allowed through? Absolutely. Do I, as a longtime staff member of the New York Times, feel proud about everything that he did? Absolutely not. What I was simply trying to do was to look at the story behind the myth, and I found that there was far more myth than there was truth to it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
New York Times reporter Anthony DePalma is author of The Man Who Invented Fidel, Castro, Cuba, and Herbert L. Matthews of the New York Times. Coming up, adulterers beware. Hackers have you nailed. This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The website Ashley Madison has the tagline, "Life is short. Have an affair." And it's aimed at people who want just that.
Well, to us, you know, the perfect affair is meeting someone and not being discovered.
CEO Noel Biederman made a vow of security last year.
So everything we do from the moment you sign up is all about the discretionary part of it.
But come on, this site is built on broken promises. This week, it was hacked by something called the Impact Team, demanding that Ashley Madison be taken down. The Impact Team claims to have information on 37 million accounts, names, addresses, photos, credit card numbers, sexual fantasies, the works, which it will release unless the site is removed. The hackers say that they're doing this because Ashley Madison charges $19 to completely delete their users' information. But then it doesn't do it. It lies. And also, its users are skeevy. Ashley Madison's parent company, Avid Life Media, says it's the hackers who are lying. Paul Ford is a programmer and writer who pondered the hack this week on Medium. Such hacks, he says, follow a typical sequence. One, a massive company fails to secure your data and someone steals it. Two, the breach is discovered, either by internal audit or when the data is released. Three, you get a letter from the company saying it takes security very seriously and is giving you free credit monitoring for a couple of years. But this latest hack is different.
The Ashley Madison hack, this is more like, one, the massive company did not secure your data. Two, you only see your kids on weekends.
Before you started writing about the Ashley Madison hack, you had a conversation with your wife?
I was going to write about this thing, and I was like, oh my God, what if she's a member? Like, I don't want that to come out later. I should check in first. And she's like, what are you even thinking? So it's a good moment for us.
Yeah.
Probably less of a good moment for other people. But It is a big group of human beings who all have one single bead of sweat coming down their forehead right now. It's easy to laugh at them, but I mean, people have their own arrangements and their own deals. If you're a person who had a bad patch in your marriage or whatever, this is a situation that sucks.
You point out that this is just the latest chapter in a series of significant online privacy violations. two summers ago, you had the Ed Snowden NSA revelations. Last summer, the hacked photos of nude celebrities. November's hack of Sony. This month, an organization called Hacking Team that sells intrusive hacking capabilities based in Italy was itself hacked. And then, of course, we all know about the Target and Home Depot and eBay and JP Morgan and the government hacks. What's this all mean, Paul?
I think it means two things. It's very, very hard to build private, secure services that are connected to the global internet. And I think everybody sort of admits we're doing it wrong, but it's really hard to do it right. And the second thing is, like, there's a real incentive not to build them right, to get as much information about everyone as possible for these big services. Because if you're Ashley Madison or anybody, you get those 37 million names. That's almost like direct mail back in the day. You can market to those 37 million people. They show up, you know a little something about them, their address.
Their sexual fantasies in the case of Ashley Madison.
Exactly. So imagine the Amazon products and the affiliate links that you can promote based on that information.
You wrote that at its heart, this problem with protecting our data stems from essentially a conflict between the centralized and decentralized internet, and that we've always been at one end or the other, swinging like a pendulum.
When the web got going, you just gave somebody some money, you got an account, and you put up a web page, and people didn't know who you were. That was the joke. Nobody knows you're a dog.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about the decentralized services is that they don't really require you to truly identify yourself. And they're very disruptive. Like Napster was a good example. Like Napster shows up and it really freaked out the music industry. Or BitTorrent and so on. And one of the reasons we have, I think, things like Netflix or Spotify is as a reaction to those decentralized services that were pretty anonymous.
And also functioning in violation of copyright rules, right?
Exactly. People weren't super excited about giving all of their intellectual property over to Apple, but it was a better solution than letting anyone download it whenever they wanted. The way that the internet's been going is there are these great, huge decentralizing moments, and then people start to figure out, like, oh, I'll get somebody to set up a username and an account, and then I'll get a little more information about them, or I want them to do their online banking with me, or whatever. And so you build these very central points, which have millions of users.
Because they're enormously convenient.
And they're enormously profitable if they're done right.
Now, decentralized data storage, as you mentioned, ensures greater anonymity, but can also lead to anonymously trading child porn, buying drugs online, intellectual property theft. Now, centralizing data is more convenient, but it leads to these massive hack attacks. That's really simplifying things, but it's essentially a rock and a hard place situation, right? Is there no middle option?
So, you know, I read this book in 2002 called Translucent Databases by a guy named Peter Weiner. And it's a short book, and it just describes an approach to obscuring data inside of a database so that it's still useful in some ways. You might know the zip code but not know the street address and so on. The user of the website, they might have full access to it. They could update their name. They could change their address, whatever. They can make decisions about how they want that information to be used as well. But what it really does is scramble the eggs. It's an approach to just hiding and obscuring as much by default as possible, adding lots of garbage and then hashing that all together into a big mess.
So this idea has been around for a while, but these big centralized sites have not picked up on it, I assume because it runs counter to their desire to market the information they've assembled or to market to their customers.
I work for big clients building websites. Like, they do not ask for this. It's going to make your marketing strategy more difficult. It's going to make all kinds of things more difficult for you.
And meanwhile, the web is becoming more centralized and more hackable. In 2001, the top 10 websites made up 31% of U.S. page views. In 2006, the top 10 made up 40%. In 2010, it made up 75% of U.S. page views. So we're just heading into hacker's heaven.
The good news here is that the big companies like Google or Twitter, like, they have really good security teams, as good as it gets. But there are points of vulnerability in the system. And sometimes one of these big companies is a point of vulnerability itself, right? Like if you can get into somebody's Gmail, then you can get into their Twitter and then just kabam. You got the keys to the kingdom. So What we want to do actually is create many, many, many more keys. You're never going to be able to lock everything down completely. But if you make it so that instead of one key to unlock everything, there are thousands or millions of keys to unlock individual pieces of that database, you might be in a better place.
Yeah, but we've discussed this with countless guests on the show for the last several years. Nothing changes except that the trespasses become more egregious and the market for credit checks and reputation management services has expanded.
Look, maybe 37 million individuals having their sex lives suddenly exposed to the world would be something that would cause people to start to take security more seriously. But we give all the secrets away right now to these giant companies. Google just released a thing that lets you look at where you've been on the map. And they're like, don't worry, it's private. But there it is. And what I saw was that I never go anywhere. Again, like you're back in that Ashley Madison zone where it's just like, uh-oh, now I have something else to keep secret. I think that's the drag of it, right? There's always something else that you have to worry about. People trying to grab your stuff. I have email going back a long time. I'm starting to wonder, like, maybe the best thing to do is just erase my own history. Just get rid of it. Maybe that's the only way out for us right now, is just to start to travel a little bit lighter, throw stuff away, have less digital footprint.
Is there something significant about the Ashley Madison hack? Is it merely salacious, or does it suggest that this whole buzzsaw moves closer and closer to, you know, our hearts of darkness?
A big chunk of North America gave its most intimate sexual details to some company in Toronto. And I'm presuming it was a little bit because it had those ads where, like, somebody would be holding their finger in front of their lips. It said it was secret. I think we're just seeing what happens when primate behavior meets services that deal with tens of millions of people. Like, this is what it looks like. Men's sexual privacy is a sacred right in our culture. And suddenly these hackers have thrown that into question.
So we're recording on Wednesday afternoon. We don't know yet whether or not the impact team will release the user data. If it does, what do you expect?
Ooh. I was thinking about this. Media organizations could go in and search around and look for particular salacious stories. I bet there's a congressman or two in there. And somebody could put up a search engine and you could go and search for your husband or wife's name. But then I started to think, like, what would actually be the worst possible thing? I was like, why even bother with journalism in the middle? Why not just put up a form letter? You know, just like, this person has this data and has these sexual fantasies, interacted with these users on the system and so on. And then I wrote about that and somebody tweeted at me, actually, you could generate emails automatically and ask people for $100 not to publish that on the internet. And so then a business plan came up. It's pretty easy to get from something like this to something just utterly terrible. It's bad for culture. It's bad for the people who are involved. It's good for divorce lawyers and marriage counselors.
This is also a week when Gawker posted a story about a married executive looking for a male escort and then took it down. Very un-Gawker-like behavior. And Nick Denton, who runs Gawker, explained it as a certain maturation process going on at Gawker. Now, we also know Gawker's being sued by Hulk Hogan for exposing some of his private life, so there's no doubt part of that in it. But do you think that there's any connection between these things, or is it just a particularly furtive sexual week?
I think it's probably always a particularly furtive sexual week, but there appear to be these cultural lines that people are defining. Like, Nick Denton said, we're going to come down on this side. Two of the editors of Gawker quit in response because there was nothing factually wrong with this story. All these technological questions are starting to come down the ethics. The hackers are talking about their ethics, and Ashley Madison has these ethics that are very problematic to people. And it feels like ethical questions are actually aligning with business goals for organizations like Gawker or Reddit. They had one set of policies, and now because they want to achieve certain things, they're changing those policies. And those policies are like, maybe we don't want to write these kind of stories anymore, or we don't want to allow this kind of content on our site. And there's a lot of fallout from that.
But how does that hook up to Ashley Madison?
The hackers take an almost journalistic role. They did their investigation, and now they're going to share what they found.
The hackers are becoming gatekeepers or gate openers.
That's a thing. We have a whole cohort of human beings in the world who see it as their mission in life to open gates. And God help us when we see what's on the other side of some of those gates.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thanks. I know this is a tricky one.
This week, programmer and writer Paul Ford wrote Fairly Random Thoughts on Ashley Madison and the Swiftly Moving Line, published on Medium. This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. You know that many of those Ashley Madison users, if they're exposed, will find themselves in serious marital trouble. But it's not likely that the ordinary guy users, the regular and not famous guy users, will find themselves publicly shamed, because the moral arbiters who rule the social media really don't care about guys who cheat, unless famously hypocritical. They do care about the women. That double standard is just one of the many insights journalist and author John Ronson shares in his book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which podcast listeners heard a few months back. Ronson's masterful investigation of public shaming, especially its online manifestations, was triggered by his own discovery that someone had started using a Twitter account in his name and with his face, an unknown entity that tweeted in a way that was utterly unlike Ronson.
Yeah, talking about how he was very much looking forward to having a dinner party and he's going to make some nice lemongrass stew. And
so this was annoying, embarrassing even, but it wasn't exactly shameful.
No.
How did that episode lead you into ultimately what became a deep exploration of shame?
Well, I asked these guys to take down their spam bot and they refused. And this went on for a couple of months. Finally, I said, look, well, if you won't take down your spam bot, they kept calling it an infomorph, can we at least meet and you can explain, you know, the rationale behind your spam bot? And they said, yeah, we'd very much like to meet to explain to you the rationale behind the infomorph. And I said, good, because I'm really looking forward to finding out the inspiration behind the spam bot. So I met them, and to cut a long story short, I filmed them for an hour. We had a huge fight, and then I put the video on YouTube and was dreading it because I'd lost my cool and I just thought everybody was going to mock my screechiness. But instead,
au contraire,
thousands of people leapt to my defense in the most visceral way.
These campaigns of vigilante justice online usually begin with reasonably voiced objections to the behavior at issue and end with death threats.
Yeah, end with gas them, which was literally one of the things that somebody wrote. So I went from feeling, you know, thrilled and delighted to starting to feel kind of uneasy.
But on the other hand, you are something of a fan and an occasional participant in social media's shame brigades, and you offer some early examples of social media shaming where greedy, exploitative people were shamed into doing the right thing. I mean, this was true democratic justice at work.
Yeah, and still is to some extent. One recent example is the Black Lives Matter protests.
On the other hand, your book deals with a darker strain that emerged. And you start off with a couple of very different but also similar cases. And I wonder if you can take them one at a time.
Sure. Jonah Lehrer was a wunderkind pop neuroscience writer.
He made stuff up and generally cut corners in presenting fascinating research that he couldn't support. Describe Jonah Lehrer's shaming.
Jonah was fired from the New Yorker, you know, obviously, and his books were recalled and pulped, and there was a lot of noise, a lot of editorials. And then it kind of died down. And then he said he was going to make an apology at a Knight Foundation lunch. The Knight Foundation is a journalist foundation. And what the Knight Foundation had done was erect a giant screen Twitter feed behind Jonah's head, and anybody could tweet their ongoing opinion of Jonah's quest for forgiveness, and their comments would appear huge right in Jonah's eyeline. So as Jonah was trying to apologise, he was seeing in real time Twitter saying, oh, Jonah Lehrer is boring us into forgiving him. Oh, Jonah Lehrer is just a frigging sociopath. Jonah Lehrer is tainted as a writer forever. He was being told that there was no way back in. There's no forgiveness. This is forever. Is that the world that we want? Where you're swallowed up by the worst things you ever did, as opposed to put within the, you know, a wider human context?
Which brings us to Justine Sacco.
Yeah. So I started to meet people who were similarly torn apart, or in fact worse than Jonah, torn apart for jokes that landed badly, for nothing. And for me, the saddest one was this woman, Justine Sacco. She was a New York City PR woman with 170 Twitter followers and a rather brittle way about her Twitter presence. So she was traveling from New York to Cape Town and tweeting, you know, acerbic little jokes. Weird German dude, get some deodorant. This is the 21st century. Chilly, bad teeth, back in London. And then the final leg, when she was at Heathrow, she tweeted, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white.
Taking that apart, it's clear that she doesn't think white people are immune to AIDS. She's making a kind of tin-eared joke about white privilege.
Yeah.
She gets on the plane.
Yeah, so she chuckles to herself when she writes this joke, presses send, wakes up 11 hours later in Cape Town, turns on her phone. Straight away, there's a text from somebody she hasn't spoken to since high school that said, I am so sorry to see what's happening to you. And then her phone, as she said to me, just exploded with texts, alerts. And her best friend, Hannah, you need to phone me immediately. You are the worldwide number one trending topic on Twitter right now. What had happened was that one of her 170 followers had sent the tweet to Sam Biddle, who's one of the main guys at Gawker, and he retweeted it to his 15,000 followers, and that just went viral within an hour or two of her, you know, just stretching out in her seat.
Tell me about how her life changed in that transatlantic flight.
Well, so at first it was philanthropic people saying, in the light of this disgusting racist tweet, I am donating to aid to Africa. So this is following then the old pattern of, you know, let's do something good. And then the trolls got involved, you know, is it terrible of me to hope that Justine Sacco gets AIDS, lol. So an awful lot of ones like that. And then celebrities got involved, like Donald Trump found it hilarious. And then people started to call for her to be fired. And so eventually her employers said, you know, this is an outrageous tweet. Employee currently on an international flight. And that's when everything changed, because it became hilarious to hundreds of thousands of people just like us that this woman was being destroyed and she didn't know it. We knew something that she didn't know. And so a hashtag began to trend worldwide, has Justine landed yet? And there were countless tweets like, oh man, I can't wait to see when Justine Sacco turns on her phone, etc., etc. You know, there's a thing in torture called the Bucha effect, where the holy grail is to debilitate somebody by startling them in a profound way. I think that's what we on Twitter learned to do that night.
So you started to think about the nature of mob mentality. And we've all heard about the research that people's better selves are extinguished when we assemble into mobs and the lizard brain emerges. And in an especially great chapter, you discovered gaping holes in that mob mentality research. And I wonder if you could briefly summarize what we thought we knew and what we don't.
Sure. You know, whenever the crowd gets frightening, we bring out the phrase group madness. And obviously there's a certain amount of this stuff that goes on. But turns out that group madness goes back to a guy called Gustave Le Bon, who is a 19th century prison. He wanted to be accepted into the Parisian elite. He was sort of nouveau riche. So he did this huge study measuring brains and came up with the theory that white, prosperous men had the biggest brains.
And women are barely above lemurs in his assessment. But what does that have to do with mob mentality?
Well, so eventually he worked out that man utterly loses free will and becomes like a grain of sand amid other grains of sand in a crowd. People loved it. This book came out, The Crowd, which was hailed by Mussolini and Goebbels and basically, you know, formed our opinion of how people behave in crowds for 100 years. To this day, in fact, just before I moved to New York, there was this big riot in London, the London riots, and it was very frightening. And everybody was starting to evoke these ideas of Gustave Le Bon. It's like these people have been infected by a virus, which means that they have no free will. And I was hearing all of this on the news, and the riot was getting closer and closer to my house. And I was terrified. We locked all the doors, and it was getting closer and closer. But we lived up a hill. And what happened was the riot stopped at the bottom of the hill.
Because somehow this mob gained enough native intelligence not to climb a hard hill in bad weather.
Right, exactly. So that didn't sound like they were infected by a virus to me at all. I think they made the very lucid decision, which is a decision that I try and make whenever I can, of not climbing the hill.
That really comprises the first section of your book. You examined, are we wired to create these kind of vigilante mobs to shame people? And you decided that we aren't necessarily wired, right? And then you transition to the next section, which has to do with what happens when you are shamed. One of the great insights that you make and then you kind of back away from, you use this guy named Max Mosley.
Yes. So Max's father was the head of the British Union of Fascists. I think probably felt pretty jealous of Hitler and Mussolini.
Right. And Max's mother was a Mitford.
Yeah, in love with Hitler. Anyway, so Max manages to shed this, you know, very dark legacy and becomes the head of Formula One Racing's governing body. So it becomes really successful. And then a few years ago, somebody phoned him up and said, have you seen the News of the World? And it was a picture of Max naked in what the News of the World called a sick Nazi orgy.
And he sues the News of the World and he wins a defamation suit because it turns out it was German, but it wasn't Nazi. So it was kind of on a technicality, but that's not the real point. The point is he goes, yeah, I like that kind of sex.
Yeah.
And this is when you had this profound insight. You theorize that perhaps, and I quote you, our shameworthiness lies in that space between who we are and how we present ourselves to the world. He said, yeah, you know, I like this S&M, B&D stuff. Sue me. It's not illegal.
Yeah.
Whereas
Jonah did the absolute opposite. Jonah maintained, in the light of like overwhelming evidence, that he was being extremely unprofessional, pretended that he was more professional than anybody else. Max said, look, everybody knows that when it comes to sex, people think and do and say strange things, and only an idiot would think me the worse for it. But, you know, lots of unashamed people still get shamed. What is it? And finally, after months and months of thinking about this, I came to the conclusion that the real reason why Max Mosley survived his shaming was that there was no shaming. We just didn't care. If you're a man in a consensual sex scandal, who cares? And what it means is that on Twitter, we have total control over people's destiny. We on Twitter have decided, Max Mosley, that's fine, we don't care. Justine Sacco, she's dead. What I found so interesting is that we haven't woken up to that realization about ourselves. We still like to see ourselves as the hitherto silenced underdog fighting the good fight. We have insane amounts of power right now. Because what's the worst sin now? The worst sin now is a misuse of privilege. Now, of course, a misuse of privilege is a worse sin than a consensual sex scandal. But we're tearing people apart for our perceived idea. And a misuse of privilege is getting wider and wider and wider as a concept.
That's right. You have to express yourself less and less so you aren't like Justine Sacco, deliberately misconstrued. Now I want to go to the penultimate part of the book, which is a profound exploration of the nature of shame. And a lot of this insight comes by way of a psychiatrist named James Gilligan. He was a Harvard-educated psychiatrist. He started examining homicidal prison population. And ultimately, he found that universal among the violent criminals was the fact that they were keeping a secret. And that secret was that they felt deeply ashamed, chronically ashamed, acutely ashamed. As children, these men were shot, axed, scalded, beaten, strangled, tortured, drugged, starved. And I'll end his quote there and just say that it would inevitably give rise to the kind of extreme behavior they took part in as adults.
Right. And he said this line that's followed me around. I think it's one of the most profound things anybody's ever said to me. He said, all violence is an attempt to replace shame with self-esteem. And I feel in that moment, other than the tiny minority of people who have a neurological absence of empathy, that feels right to me. And yet, here we are. I think what a lot of people forget was when Twitter began, it was the opposite of how it was now. It was actually like a kind of radical de-shaming exercise. People would blab out their hitherto shameful secrets because, you know, as James Gilligan's research shows, shame internalized leads to horror. Shame let out leads to freedom or, if nothing else, a funny story. And that's what people were doing on Twitter. So it was a wonderful thing. And then what did we do with it? We started to use it against ourselves and created this cold, brittle, conservative thing when if somebody admits their shameful secret, we destroy them for it.
As you wind down, you talk about what's the solution, at least to online shaming that can destroy lives. And you talk about a lovely person who worked with the disabled.
Loveliest, just the most ordinary person in the world. Her name's Lindsay Stone. She used to have this running joke with her friend Jamie where they would make fun of signs. So, you know, smoking in front of a no smoking sign and so on. So they went to Arlington, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And as she said to me, inspiration struck. There's a picture of her in front of the silence and respect sign. And she's flipping the finger and pretending to shout. Mm-hmm. You know, again, much like Justine, not the best joke in the world. You know, nobody's saying that it is. But she posted it on Facebook. And then a month passed. Nothing happened. And then suddenly it went viral and she was fired and became agoraphobic, deeply traumatized, felt utterly worthless. There's nothing worse. I can really tell you this, that something that people don't realize is that being publicly shamed.
You suggest it's a kind of death. Gilligan said that yeah. The word mortification means to deaden.
You know, to be told that you're worthless and you're out, you're out of society.
So how do you fix this?
Well, there's a team of people in San Francisco, a company called Reputation.com.
I want to say, full disclosure, they have been a sponsor of this program at some point.
Unfortunately, it costs a hell of a lot of money. It will cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to correct the kind of mistake that, you know, Lindsay Stone made.
And you decided to cover what they did for your book. They wanted a subject. You landed on Lindsay Stone.
Yeah, and it's the only way that she would agree to talk to me too, because she was just too traumatized mm-hmm. to tell the story, but I offered her quite the incentive. And it really worked wonders. But the really sad thing about it is, I'd listen in on these conference calls between Lindsay and Reputation.com. Basically, what they do is try and replace the silly, impudent, foolhardy mistake that she made with pleasant banalities. What's your favorite type of ice cream? What do you think about Lady Gaga's new jazz album?
An unobjectionably bland human being, a Donna Reed for the internet.
Yeah, because we have created a world where the smartest way to survive is to be bland.
And it worked.
It worked.
Her objectionable picture fell down in the rankings until, of course, the end of February, when your Guardian feature came out about your book. The photograph was there again.
I asked her, what do you think about that? She said that talking to me was very cathartic, and she also felt that it's really important to be part of the discussion, which she is. And I think that Lindsay's story and Justine's story in my book might actually change people's behaviour. Not think twice before you tell an impudent joke, but think twice before you destroy somebody for telling an impudent joke.
You conclude by saying, I personally no longer take part in the ecstatic public condemnation of people unless they've committed a transgression that has an actual victim. And you've noted that there usually isn't a victim.
Yeah. And I don't think that's the perfect ending. The other day I did an interview and the interviewer said something along the lines of, yeah, you're right. People should be allowed to make risque jokes. For instance, there was somebody the other day making fun of a transgender person, called them like a Fruit Loop. And, you know, what's wrong with that? And actually, there is something wrong with that.
Yeah, it isn't about feel free to be as objectionable and offensive as you want.
That's the opposite of what I'm saying, because, of course, when you insult a transgender person, you're shaming. That's what you're doing. But I think twice before gleefully condemning somebody for doing almost nothing wrong.
You said that you miss the fun a little, but it feels like when you became a vegetarian, you missed the steak, although not as much as you anticipated, but you could no longer ignore the slaughterhouse.
Because I've met so many of these people now who've been destroyed in this way, and it's agonizing to meet them. We have no idea how severe our punishments are.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Ronson is a journalist and author of the book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Sam Dingman, and Jenna Cagle. We had more help from Maya Brownstein, and our show was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippin. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.